because we changed leadership in the country and things are quite uncertain. But uncertainty is the nature of cyclic existence. Yeah, things are always uncertain in samsara. So we have to learn to adapt to new circumstances, to accept uncertainty and the lack of control we have over many things in our lives. But to remember that the one thing that we can manage is our own mind, and that's the most crucial thing for us to take care of. And so whatever is happening in the external environment around us, the determination to be free of cyclic existence, the altruistic intention of bodhicitta, the wisdom realizing emptiness, these are always applicable. They're always useful, no matter what's going on, good or bad or otherwise. And so to really take refuge in these Dharma trainings, in these Dharma realizations, and try to develop them in our own hearts and minds, knowing that as we do, we can keep our own mind balanced, our heart open to others, and operate with wisdom in the world. And if we can do that, well, then our life is quite meaningful and the result of what we do will be good. So let's keep our minds stable and fully immersed in our Dharma practice. So that we can really work for the welfare of beings in the very uncertain, unstable situation of cyclic existence. So let's have that be our motivation for learning the Dharma and for practicing it as we go on in life. Said, I read that exchanging self and others can be used to deal with negative emotions through compassion.
Precisely.
The instruction that I read in Dilgo Kenze's book, The Heart of Compassion, describes that we can take a person we don't like after we have cultivated a bodhicitta motivation. We develop compassion towards that person and start adding the negative emotions, for example, attachment of that person to our own, and imagine this person becomes free of their affliction. So, you know, in our practice of exchanging self and others, we'll get to the part on the thought training, on the tonglen, the taking and giving. And so when we take from other beings. We take not only their suffering, but the cause of it, which is their afflictions. So we can think of their attachment, their anger, their jealousy, and whatever. And we imagine taking that on to ourselves so that the other person is free of that. Okay? And she said, and then we start with somebody we don't like, and then progressively we take on the attachment or anger or whatever of all living beings upon ourselves, and imagine that they're free of the afflictions. Okay? So it's not just that we take it and they're free of the afflictions and instantaneously attain full awakening. Okay, because we have to really think of taking the afflictions, taking the cognitive obscurations. And we don't just take those and then they all sit like pollution inside of us, making us sick. But we think that they, you know, become like a thunderbolt that destroys the lump at our heart of our own self-grasping. You know? And then we have to give to them by imagining giving our body possessions and merit. Okay. After we give to them, then we can imagine they have all the conducive conditions for Dharma practice. They practice well and then they attain the realizations. Okay, so you have to do all the steps. And then she said, Dilgo Khyentse speaks here about taking the negative emotions according to the relative truth. That's what I just described. Then he continues to describe the meditation according to the ultimate truth by arousing in us an overwhelming feeling of, for example, desire. We fuel that by adding the desire of all beings to make it a great mountain of desire. Then he instructs us to look right into it, and we will see that desire is nothing but thoughts. It appears in our mind, but it does not have even the tiniest particle of independent existence. So, yeah, you can do that when you take on the desire or anger of whatever. You can imagine just it's all the attachment, jealousy, whatever, in the universe. Yeah, and it's ours and others. Yeah, but then when you ask yourself, okay, what is desire, for example, or what is anger, for example? All you see is thoughts. Yeah, conceptual minds. That's all the afflictions are. That's all. Yeah? That's all. They don't have hands and legs. They don't have form. They don't have super glue on them that sticks to you. All these things that make us so miserable, that control our mind and the minds of others, are nothing but thoughts. And when you try and locate a thought, you can't find it. I mean, first of all, it doesn't have form, color, shape, or whatever, so you can't find it. But when you actually even ask yourself, what is anger, for example, or what is attachment, you know, what are you going to say? Can you say it's one thought? Because if it's that one thought that you had at 6:05 on Tuesday, then what about the thought that you had at 6:06 on Wednesday? Is that also anger? If you identify one thought moment as being anger, then what about all the other thought moments that are similar to that moment of anger, but aren't exactly like, you know, the same thing? Why aren't they the same thing? Maybe one day you're mad at this person, next day you're mad at the other person. Yeah. One day it's mild anger, one day it's strong anger. You know, in other words, is anger something solid that is just sitting there hanging around, haunting you, yeah, that is permanent and never changes. What is this anger of self and others when you really look at what it is? Can you find it? Yeah. When you look for what it is, all you find is a bunch of different mind moments that have some common quality in that they're based on exaggeration of the negative aspects of someone or something, and then desire to strike or run away. Okay? So they all have that kind of quality, but they aren't the same. And so it makes you, it's very interesting because I think sometimes psychologically the way people talk, it's like people say, well, I have, what is it, repressed anger. As if there is this thing called repressed anger that's kind of floating around us all the time. You know, we can't see it because it's repressed, but it's floating around. And every once in a while it goes, wah! And then it's rah for a while, and then it gets repressed again. But it's still there, that concrete thing called repressed anger floating around up your nose, your throat, inside your tummy, you know, and you can't shake it off, and it's this real thing. We have that idea, that feeling, don't we? That that's what our anger is. It's something that's, you know. But when you look at it, can you find anger? Or can you find attachment? All you can find is mind moments that are examples of anger or examples of attachment. But all those mind moments are different moments. They aren't the same moment. And there's no kind of sneaky thing around you that is anger. Repressed anger, always haunting you, making you get ulcers. You know, we come to see that anger is just something. It's a bunch of moments of mind that are similar. And because of the similarities, our mind conceptualizes them as, you know, okay, they're similar moments. And then we give them one label, one term, anger. Yeah. But it's actually many, many different things that are not the same. And there's not one thing that's anger there that you can identify and draw a line around. Okay? So it's quite interesting when you really start looking at it. Okay, so this is what I think he's getting at here. You know, you begin to see there's nothing but thoughts. Yeah, it doesn't have the tiniest particle of independent existence because you can't even find what it is when you search. And then he asks us to turn the mind inward to look at ourselves. We become aware that the mind too is without any inherent existence in either the past, present, or future. The nature of the mind is as insubstantial as the sky. Yeah, so you make an example of, you know, you see the emptiness of anger. Then you turn it to the rest of what we call mind, and we see that there's nothing that we can draw a line around and say, this is my mind, either. That all there are is a whole bunch of moments of clarity and cognizance. That, you know, they have that similar quality of clarity and cognizance. But it's our conceptual mind that puts them together because of the similar things. And then when we give it one name, then we think it's one thing that exists from its own side. But it isn't one thing, and it isn't out there, yeah, with its own essence. Okay. So can you speak about this application of the two truths in regard to exchanging self and others? Well, I think I just did. Is this a meditation instruction you would encourage and would generally teach myself? Yes. Yeah, so it's good to do that. Yeah. And then similarly, when you generate love and compassion when you're doing the taking and giving meditation, you look for what is love too, and you see that love or compassion, whatever you're choosing, is just a bunch of moments of mind that have similar characteristics. In the sense of compassion, they have the characteristic of wanting somebody to have to be free of dukkha and the causes of dukkha. In love, they have the characteristic of wanting somebody to have happiness and its causes. Yeah. But again, love and compassion, you can't identify, there it is. Yeah, and draw a line out around it. And say, there's my love. Here it is. And I'm going to water it, you know. Yeah. Because again, you know, these are mental states that are totally physically insubstantial. They don't have color and shape. But their lack of color and shape is not their emptiness of inherent existence. Okay? Those are just conventional qualities of it. And realizing that helps us create a little bit more space about these mental states in our mind instead of seeing them as so concrete. Yeah. But to see their emptiness, we have to really see that when searched for, you can't find anything that is it. And that whether it's love or whether it's anger, you know, it arises due to causes. It has many moments which are its parts. And it depends on the mind putting those parts together and then giving it a label, a term, a designation. And then our problem is we forgot that our mind put the parts together and gave it a designation, and instead we think from its side it has its own nature coming towards us. Yeah. So that's the problem in our mind, how we create grasping at inherent existence. Okay? Good. Okay, then to review a little bit from last week, we talked about the five decisions that we make. Yeah, and so these come after the 9 points of equalizing self and others and equalizing friend, enemy, and stranger. But they come before actually doing the meditations to see the disadvantages of self-centeredness and the benefits of cherishing others. So it's kind of like you're looking at these meditations and you're becoming convinced that they have some purpose and that what they're saying is actually something that is possible to do. Okay? So the first one, okay, the verse in Lama Chopa is, there is no difference between myself and others. None of us wishes even the slightest suffering or is ever content with the happiness we have. Realizing this, I seek your inspiration to enhance the bliss and joy of others. Okay, so this is based on equalizing self and others, and because of seeing ourselves and others as equal, then wanting to help to work for the benefit of others. Then the second verse, this chronic disease of self-centeredness, is the cause for all our unwanted suffering. Perceiving this, I seek your inspiration to blame, begrudge, and destroy this monstrous demon of selfishness. Okay, so the first one was, you know, based on equalizing, and it was a decision to open our hearts towards others without favoritism. Yeah. And then this one is really seeing self-centeredness as our real enemy. Okay. So for those of us who are upset with, you know, the election, to really see, yeah, that the new president is not our enemy, our own self-centeredness is. Yeah, the new president is a sentient being who wants happiness and doesn't want suffering and is very confused about how to create the causes for the happiness and abandon the causes for suffering. Yeah, so he has his own set of problems. Okay. And he's suffering from self-centeredness, just as we are. And in fact, he's, you know, people are delighting in saying, oh, he's so narcissistic. You know, everything just revolves around him. Isn't that a good example for how we are? Yeah? So all the time we point the finger and say, look at him. He's just, you know, making himself indispensable and putting himself as the savior of the country. Well, in our own little environment, don't we see ourselves as the savior of all the people around us? Because if they only listened to our wise advice, they would be happy and the world would be better. Yeah? Do we have that same tendency that he does? Yeah. I'm going to tell you what to do and just shut up and follow my advice and then everything will be fine. Yeah, we have that view too. We're not any different from him. Okay. We can't sign executive orders. But we certainly have a lot of executive orders that come out of our mouth, don't they? Yeah. Today, you are to do this. Except we don't say it like that. We say, your offering service job today is shining the shoes, whether you like it or not. Don't complain. They're the shoes, shine, you know, or whatever it is, okay. So, self-centeredness is self-centeredness, isn't it? Yeah, who are we to kind of stand back and say, well, I am so superior, I am not narcissistic like him. But.
So you're asking us to look at our own mind and look for those issues that we point our finger to others. Okay. So now we work with it. Mm-hmm. But we want to do something about what's going on.
With us.
And also with, you know, like tomorrow we're going to walk and
yeah,
all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So you're asking us to, when we pass into action, that make sure that we are passing into action from a place of compassion.
Yes.
Not from a place, I'm going to show you what the right thing is to do.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You go and march, but you're marching, you know, with a big understanding of what samsara is and how you're miserable in it and he's miserable in it. And, you know, you may have a little bit more awareness of the misery of samsara and how certain policies create misery for sentient beings and how certain attitude creates misery. But we're not presenting ourselves as, you know, the God on high that everybody has to listen to. Then the third one, okay, so that one, the second one, was seeing the disadvantages of self-centeredness. That's pretty easy to tell. Then the third verse, the attitude that cherishes all mother sentient beings and would secure them in bliss is the source from which arises boundless virtuous qualities. Seeking this, I seek your inspiration to cherish these beings more than my life, even should they all rise up as my enemy. So there, you know, it's a decision to really cherish others. First one was a decision to care for everybody equally. Second one, to see the self-centeredness as the enemy. Third one, to cherish to see the benefits of cherishing others and to actually cherish them. Okay, so then when you go march tomorrow, you're going with that attitude that, you know, cherishes other living beings, and that you're doing that, making your voice heard, because you care about living beings, not because you're angry and you want to destroy somebody or something, but because you care and you want to bring that that approach to solving problems to the attention of the world. I was at a march in Dharamsala one time, you know, because they frequently have marches, especially if somebody from China is visiting India or something like that. So they start up the hill and then everybody holds candles and they go to the temple and then there's some speeches and then everybody walks down to the library where the government offices are. Now, you know, sometimes they have the thing Tibet for Tibetans, they chant that. But the one I was at, the chant was... the Tibetan goes, Janchu Semcho Rinpoche Ma Kepanyam Gheger Chen Kepanyam Ba Meparyang Gone Gone Pelwar Shog. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that aborn. May that already arise, increase forevermore. I can never say it when I have to do it by myself. Anyway, that's what they were chanting in a protest march of Chinese, you know, communist Chinese occupation of Tibet. I thought, wow, I've never been to a protest march where everybody is chanting a verse about bodhicitta. Yeah, that was pretty significant. Maybe tomorrow you can chant that. Yeah, do the English of it. Yeah, but to just think, you know, that's how you're protesting, is you're bringing to attention of the world the importance of bodhicitta, and how if people heed that, it can help, you know, with the problems that are happening. Then the fourth one, is, in brief, so that was the third decision. Fourth decision, in brief, infantile beings labor only for their own ends, while Buddhas work solely for the welfare of others. Discerning the disadvantages of one and the advantages of the other, I seek your inspiration to be able to equalize and exchange self and others. Okay, so this one, you've done the, you know, it's making the decision to actually equalize and exchange self for others. Okay, so the first three are like the causes leading up to making this decision here. Okay, and then the fifth decision, the verse says, since cherishing ourselves is the doorway to all torment, while cherishing our mothers is the foundation of all that is good, inspire me to make my core practice the yoga of exchanging self for others. Okay, and so here the decision is to devote ourselves one-pointedly to practicing exchanging self and others. Okay. The verse after that in the Lama Chöpa is the taking and giving verse, but these are the five decisions that come before it. Okay? So last time when we also were saying that to have the attitude that wants to benefit others, then that is intent on benefiting them, then we have to see others as lovable. And so in the seven-point instruction, yeah, we do that by the first three points. And then here, we're doing it by equalizing and exchanging self for others. Okay, so then we go, next step is to really go into the disadvantages of self-centeredness. Okay, so there's different levels of self-centeredness, different layers of self-centeredness. Okay, the real self-centeredness that the Mahayana path is striking at is the self-centeredness that looks out for our own nirvana and neglects the liberation of others. Okay? That's the real one that's differentiating the path of the hearers and solitary realizers versus the bodhisattvas, is whether there's the motivation to liberate, to attain full awakening in order to liberate all beings, or there isn't that intention. Okay? So the self-centeredness that just cares about our own liberation, that practices the three higher trainings and, you know, serenity and insight so that we can get awakened, yeah, that's the self-centeredness that is the one that the Mahayana really wants to overcome, okay, in order to practice the bodhisattva path. Okay. Now, there's also a general kind of self-centeredness that is actually kind of mushed in together with self-grasping, in the sense that due to self-grasping ignorance, we have attachment, anger, jealousy, pride, all those other afflictions. And those other afflictions are also underlain by self-centeredness. Because when we're attached to things, you know, who are we caring the most about? When we are angry at somebody, who are we centered most on? When we're jealous, when we're arrogant, when we're lazy, when we have no integrity, no consideration for others, what is fueling all these defilements? Not only the self-grasping ignorance, but this general self-centeredness that is just, you know, I'm more important than others. You know, that's very attached to our own happiness. Okay? So that self-centeredness, you know, here, It seems to be very much mixed in with the afflictions. And so then we start to think, oh, maybe that self-centeredness is an afflictive obscuration. Yeah. Self-centeredness itself is not an afflictive obscuration. Yeah. And it's not a cognitive obscuration. It's called, it starts with an I, it just went out of my mind. Not intermediate. What's the word? Inferior obscuration.
Oh, an inferior.
It's called an inferior obscuration. Okay? Because it makes us take an inferior path. I assume that's why it's so called. Okay? So it's neither of the two obscurations that we get rid of by the wisdom realizing emptiness. Okay? So when we have a self-centeredness and self-grasping ignorance, okay, self-centeredness is removed by bodhicitta, self-grasping ignorance is overcome by the wisdom realizing emptiness. So they have different antidotes. But we also take self-centeredness in a very general way and see how it's mixed in with all of our afflictions too. Okay? And so then when we look at things, we think other people are the problem, not realizing that self-centeredness is our problem. Okay? So, you know, this is interesting because this whole thing of what's the source of our happiness and misery is such a crucial thing in Buddhism. You know, whether you're going to practice the method side of the path or the wisdom side of the path, they both involve realizing that the source of our turmoil is in here. It's not out there. And the source of our happiness is in here. It's not out there. And this is something we have to keep reminding ourselves of again and again and again, because since beginningless time, we've been very familiar with the idea that the source of my happiness is out there. So I just have to get the things I want, be near the people I want, live in the place I like, have the perfect external situation, and be free of everything that I don't like, because that external stuff is the cause of my suffering. And it's that very view that is so ingrained in us that makes it difficult for us to see our self-centeredness as the actual enemy, and to see our self-grasping ignorance as a culprit. Yeah? Because we're so focused on if only the external world would change and the people in it would change, then everything would be great. I was thinking, you know, Trump, a few weeks ago, he did that thing with the carrier. Yeah. Yeah, so they became the latest welfare queen. Because all these subsidies to corporations by giving them tax breaks, that's corporate welfare. The government is paying for it. The taxpayers are paying for it. You know, carrier, they held on to those jobs, but those same people who have that jobs are going to be paying the taxes that support the corporations. Okay, anyway, that's not the topic of tonight's talk. But what I was thinking about is those people were so happy to have their jobs saved. And I thought, what are they so happy about? So happy about working for the same company for, what, 45, 50 years? And having their house and their family and all the problems that come with house family job. And that's all they have to look forward to. Because Trump rescued them from whatever. I thought, that's really sad, isn't it? You know? I mean, yeah, having your job and your paycheck is better than not having it. But when the whole meaning of your life is working 9 to 5 for 45 years at the same company, and that's the joy of your life, you know? I mean, that's coming from the view that my happiness is outside, isn't it? Yeah? And having that job is not going to make them everlastingly happy. Because as long as you have ignorance, anger, and attachment inside, no matter where we go, what we do, whatever's going on, we're going to find something to complain about. Aren't we? Yeah, we know this from our own experience, don't we? Yeah? Like something is driving us crazy. Finally, we've solved that problem. It's over. Then, oh, what relief. But then that lasts for how long? And then our mind finds something else to bellyache about. Yeah? So the source is our self-centered mind. Yeah?
How do you get in touch with that part of your mind that doesn't know that the mind is the source of happiness and pain? Because, you know, on the intellectual level, it's very clear, but, you know, there's another part of your brain, I guess. How do you access that and convince it that it's otherwise?
The only way is repetition. By again and again making examples to yourself of how that view has deceived you, how that view has cheated you. And you make many, many examples in your own life, again and again. And you go back and you think about those examples again and again. You know, that's the way to do it, you know, until, how do they say, it gets through our thick skull. And you just start looking at everything, you know, as you go through the day, you know, whatever today's complaint is. Yeah, because we have a new complaint every day, don't we? And then, okay, yeah, if that complaint gets solved, then what? Then am I going to be everlastingly happy? No. Yeah. Yeah. If Trump wasn't inaugurated and Hillary was, or if Obama could have a third term, do you think he'd be everlastingly happy?
At least for 4 years.
For 4 days. Yeah.
4 years.
4 years.
4 years. But, you know, you think some, you know, none of that is going to solve our problem of being in samsara. None of it is. It might make our samsara a little nicer, but it's not going to solve our fundamental problem. Yeah. And you're not going to stay in single-pointed concentration of, you know, Hillary's president. Obama has a third term, you know? Yeah, that's not one of the objects the Buddha recommended for cultivating serenity. Okay. So, you know, this meditation on seeing the disadvantages of self-centeredness is quite important, you know, and we have to keep looking at it, keep pointing the finger at it. So there must be some kind of text. I don't know what this is taken from, but Khyentse Rinpoche in Transforming Adversity into Joy and Courage has some little slogans here. Must be from one of the Kadampa thought, you know, mind training texts. So this is what you say to yourself, okay? Self-centeredness, you are a slaughterer. Instead of self-centeredness, you're my best friend. Self-centeredness, you're a butcher, okay? Yeah, so butchers take life. Yeah, what does our self-centeredness do? It severs the life of, you know, fortunate rebirths, liberation, and awakening. Okay, how does it do this? It makes us think, for example, that there's no benefit from taking refuge, or that the three jewels don't exist, or that karma is a bunch of not hokey pokey, hokey. What? Hocus pocus. No, hocus pocus is what you say to catch a spell. Hui. Hui. The cause and effect is a bunch of hui. They don't say that in Canadian?
Not really.
What do you say in Canadian?
Crap.
Yes.
That's French. That's when you have to say, excuse my French. Okay. So, hui balooey. That's it. Hui balooey.
It's a bunch of
baloney.
Baloney. That too. Baloney. You new English words. Did you know those words before? Oh, see, your vocabulary is increasing. Okay. So, yeah. So we say, you know, self-centeredness, you're a butcher. You're cutting my lifeline to happiness by making me have wrong views about karma and its effects, about the three jewels. Yeah. Okay. Self-centeredness, you are a robber. You're a thief. You're a burglar. You're a
terrorist.
Yeah, that's coming. Okay. Yeah, burglars don't seem so bad now. Okay. So a robber deprives us of our possessions, but by making us do unkind things towards other living beings, then self-centeredness takes away our happiness. Yeah, because we harm sentient beings who are the cause of our happiness, thereby creating negative karma, you know, causing suffering to the beings who upon whom we depend for our own happiness. Then the next one is self-centeredness, you are a troublemaker. Troublemaker's too mild. I think here we can say self-centeredness, you are a terrorist. Okay? Because together with self-grasping, it causes the imprints of destructive karma to accumulate in our mind stream. And that terrorizes us. and makes us receive harm, humans and non-humans and whatever. Okay. Self-centeredness, you are a farmer of evil. Or a grower of evil. So not even a grower of marijuana, a grower of evil. Okay. So farmers sow seeds in their field and they put the water in the fertilizer and they grow various crops. And so similarly here, under the influence of self-centeredness and self-grasping, we plant lots of seeds of destructive karma in our mind stream. Those will ripen at the time of death and propel us into other rebirths. They're nourished by craving and clinging at the time of death, propel us into another rebirth. Okay? So they're like farmers of destruction, basically. Okay, then we keep insulting self-centeredness. Okay, self-centeredness, you are a lazy bum. Okay? So that's a good one. Yeah, to really blame our self-centeredness. Lazy bum. Do you know that term? Bum? Lazy bum? Bum is lazy, you know. Yeah? Bum is B-U-M. A lazy bum is us. A lazy bum is someone who doesn't want to make any effort to do anything good for themselves. They're just lazy and they sit around and expect everything to magically appear for them. Yeah? So, self-centeredness, you are a lazy bum. So, you know, once upon a time, somewhere in our previous lifetimes, we knew the previous continuity of the person who became Shakyamuni Buddha. And we were friends with that person. Yeah, because the Buddha hasn't always been a Buddha, so he was once an ordinary being. We used to hang out with that ordinary being. Yeah, it was in that same continuity. You know, going to the beach, going to the disco, you know, checking the stock market, those kind of things. Then, yeah, all these years later, you know, that being is now Shakyamuni Buddha, and we're still lying on the beach, just checking the stock market, not doing anything, you know. So why? What's the difference? Why was that person able to be successful and become fully awakened, and we weren't, you know, because our self-centeredness made us into a lazy bum. Yeah. So these are all, you know, when we were doing the Pratimoksha, you know, the precepts, one of them was about not calling people names, I mean the meaning of it. Mm. How was it worded?
Not slander others.
Not slander others, but the meaning was like not calling them bad names. But here, we're taking the same tendency to call people bad names, but we're applying it to the self-centered thought. Okay? So it's very important when you're doing this that you don't think of your self-centered thought as who you are, or as part of you, okay? You know, the conventional person is just the conventionally existent person. The self-centered thought is not a part of that conventionally existent I, that mere I, you know? It's some extra added garbage on top of the pure nature of the mind. So don't identify with your self-centeredness. Yeah. So this is the problem sometimes Westerners fall into, is they think, I am selfishness incarnate. You know, selfishness is in me, I am selfishness. So then when you see the fault of selfishness, you're pointing at yourself and saying, what a lousy person I am, I'm so selfish. Yeah? So that's very reminiscent, or it may be reminiscent, of how you were raised as a child, or what you were told if you studied another religion before. You know, that you are original sin, you are selfishness. Even the scientific view, yeah, they tell us we're hardwired to be selfish. What a view of human beings. Yeah, and so then when you try and meditate on the disadvantages of self-centeredness, what you wind up doing is hating yourself for being selfish. That is not the correct way to do this meditation. Repeat. This is not the correct way to do this meditation. Okay? I had a friend of mine. I was teaching at a Dharma center in California, and she was an old friend of mine, and so we were kind of catching up. And she was telling me that you know, she was always troubled by this thing of, you know, seeing self-centeredness as something so bad and feeling very guilty about it. Whenever she did the meditation on the disadvantages of self-centeredness, she felt guilty, she hated herself, she thought she was bad for being so selfish. So she went to ask one Lama about it. So the Lama didn't speak English, she didn't speak Tibetan, it was going through a translator. And she, explained the situation. But the Lama, not understanding this particular aspect of minds that have grown up this lifetime in a Western culture, or in a Christian culture, or whatever it is that is behind that, when she said, is this the way I'm supposed to feel at the end of the meditation? He said, yes. And when she told me that, I said, uh-uh, that's not how we're supposed to feel, you know. This was a mistake, maybe happening because it was a translation issue, maybe happening because he didn't understand what your real issue, what your real question was, you know, because we think I am selfishness. And then if you're going to selfishness, you're a bomb. Selfishness, you're a terrorist. Selfishness, you're a thief. It sounds like you're beating up on yourself, on your conventional self, and hating yourself. That's not what this meditation is about. Absolutely not. Because coming to that conclusion is not a virtuous mind that inspires you to practice, is it? Yeah? If you ever meditate and arrive at a conclusion that is a non-virtuous mind and that discourages you from practicing, realize that you haven't done the meditation correctly and that you need to go back and ask questions about how to do this meditation and what is the conclusion, the correct conclusion you're supposed to draw from it. Okay? This is quite important because otherwise, you know, our mind, confused in ignorance, comes up with the wrong conclusion and then thinks that we've understood what the Buddha has said. Okay? So it took me a lot of making mistakes to understand this, yeah. That if I'm coming out of a session angry, you know, or whatever, or discouraged, then I haven't really done the meditation correctly. I may come out of the meditation sober, but more sober mind, Like when you meditate on the disadvantages of cyclic existence, that makes your mind sober. But if you take a step and go from making your mind just sober, from realizing the what is, to being discouraged, then you've added something extra onto the meditation that was not the Buddha's intent. Yeah? Because we don't need to meditate to become discouraged, do we? We can do that all by ourselves. Who needs to meditate to become discouraged? Who needs to meditate to hate ourselves? We're very good at doing that all by ourselves. Okay? So it's really important in this meditation that we separate ourselves, you know, from the self-centeredness and see the self-centeredness. We can anthropomorphize it. That's fine. You know, make it look like some kind of demon or devil and think that you've taken this mental state, yeah, that is not you, and you've put it, you know, like artists put feelings into colors. So we've anthropomorphized this, and you can make it look like a spirit or a whatever you want it to look like, you know. And then you point your finger at it. Or maybe you don't anthropomorphize it. You just, oh, that's my self-centered mind. And you say, you're the lazy, good-for-nothing bum. Yeah? Because you see how that attitude has harmed you. So instead of identifying that's me, you're saying you are self-centeredness. You're the cause of the problem. Okay? Well, this is important, okay? Another thing, why I'm trying to clarify stuff here, is some people translate it as self-cherishing. This, I think, is a very poor translation, and it's very, very confusing, okay? Why is it confusing? Because we say, self-cherishing, you're a terrorist, you're a lazy bum, you're a good for nothing. So then we think, well, okay, cherishing myself is bad. So what's the opposite of cherishing myself? Hating myself. And then that goes, it feeds right into how we put ourselves down and hate ourselves. So actually, we should cherish ourselves in the proper way. Yeah. We are a sentient being. We have the Buddha nature. We are valuable. We need to appreciate ourselves and cherish ourselves. If we don't cherish ourselves and our Buddha potential, then what are we going to do with our lives? So we need to cherish ourselves, but cherishing ourselves does not mean being self-indulgent. Okay? Cherishing ourselves means respecting ourselves as a living being who has the potential to become fully awakened. Shouldn't you respect yourself for that? Or respect that part of yourself? Yeah? Of course we should. Yeah? And we should nurture that part of ourselves. Yeah? If we hate ourselves, if we think I shouldn't cherish myself and fall into hating ourselves, that's completely contrary to what the Buddha's trying to get us to feel. He's trying to get us to see that we have amazing potential. Okay. So that's why I think self-cherishing is a very confusing translation and why I encourage people not to use that. Yeah? self-centeredness, self-preoccupation, selfishness, those, I think, have the right connotation. Yeah, that we can say, yeah, I'm self-preoccupied. But we don't have to hate ourselves for that. Okay. Okay. Okay, then the next one is covetous, self-centered attitude. Yeah, greedy. Be better. Greedy is better, isn't it? Greedy self-centeredness. Yeah. So, why is it greedy? Because this self-centeredness, it's greedy for samsaric things. It wants possessions, it wants status, it wants money, it wants food, it wants places, it wants, you know, honor, it wants fame, it wants to get its way. So it's very greedy. Yeah. And it's true, isn't it? Our self-centered attitude's very greedy. I want this, I want that, give me this, give me that. All the time. Okay, then the next one is hopeful and fearful self-centeredness. Your self-centeredness, you are full of false hopes and false fears. Okay, that's a better, maybe better way to say it. Yeah, you're full of false hopes and false fears. Yeah, and so the meaning of this is sometimes we put our hopes and our energies into all sorts of things, thinking that they're going to bring us real happiness and do so much good, and in actual fact, we're wasting our time and energy. Yeah? Especially doing worldly things. Okay? And other times, we fabricate things that we're afraid of, we're suspicious of other people. We think they're going to put us down, they're going to harm us, they're going to do something to us. So we create all these fearful things, you know, that we then attack others for, or we devise some plan of escape, how we can get out of the situation without getting hurt, you know, again, which is a whole big waste of time. So self-centeredness, you're full of false hopes and false fears. And we are full of those, aren't we? Yeah? Yeah. What kind of false hopes do you have? What kind of false fears do you have? Let's have some examples.
I think sometimes the self-centeredness that runs through my mind is the fear of not being able to progress on the path and to think, you know, can't do it. Mm-hmm. That's self-centeredness.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a completely false fear, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah.
I'm inherently a really bad person, and people see it without me talking.
So that's the false fear, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Big waste of time.
My big false fear right now is that if I am not adored and praised, I will wither and die.
Yeah. That's a false fear, isn't it?
I hope so.
Yeah. Oh, you're really so wonderful. Isn't she wonderful? Yeah. No, you have plenty of inner strength. You're not going to wither and die.
Sure. And then there's perpetual false hope that what I do will be good enough to garner praise.
Oh, yeah. Okay. The false hope. If I only do this well.
Well enough.
Well enough. Then I'll get the praise that I want. That I've deserved all my life and
need.
The universe has
need.
Designed
need.
Me. Oh, sorry. Need. The praise I need. It's a truly existent, justified human need that there's nothing wrong with needing, and I'm never going to credit, never going to question my need for praise. Mm-hmm. Or my need for being good enough.
And then a false hope.
What else?
All right, false hope. If I could forget everything I've learned in the past year and go back to an island with a nice beach and my friends and live happily ever after, no worry about rebirth.
It's really a false hope, isn't it?
I think there's just a false hope that this, that, or the other thing is going to give us happiness, some external source, and the fear that some external source is going to interfere with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
False hope that as a mother I can make my child become the person I want him to be.
Oh, wow.
And then everyone will think I'm a good mother.
Oh, painful.
Oh, that one's so painful, isn't it? So painful. You know what? Whoever that mother is, none of us sitting here in this room are what our parents wanted us to be. Yeah. Are any of you what your parents wanted you to be?
They didn't know. Yeah. They wanted me to have shorter hair, wear dresses, so...
Wait, you can teach this.
Short hair. I find this funny thing. Yeah, get the hair out of your face. Why don't you ever wear dresses? Why don't you take up sewing? All the things I'm doing.
Yeah, all the things you're now doing, and they still aren't happy, are they?
I think my mother wanted me to be a religious person, but wrong religion.
Yeah, and my father kept telling me, same as your mother, get your hair out of your face. And then I did. Okay, so lots of false hopes and false fears. Okay, oh, there's still some more things here. Yeah, but it's already 8:30. Any more questions or comments? Yeah. Okay.
Why do fear and anger suddenly rear up in your mind when you think you have started to get them under control in meditation?
Because, okay. If you have an external enemy, like ISIS, and you start attacking your external enemy, are they going to surrender? No. They're going to put up a fight. Yeah? So the same thing. Yeah? We're working on our anger, or we're working on whatever thing we're working on. We're getting somewhere with it. But it isn't like anger is going to roll over on its back and say, I surrender. Yeah. It's saying, I've been sticking up for you since beginningless time. You've got to listen to me. Yeah. So that there's that, and also because you're working on your anger, you're seeing it in places where you never saw it before. So you may think it's getting worse, but it's not. It's just you're noticing it. So you have to continue. Continue practicing fortitude. Other questions, comments?
Yes,
okay.
How or what should I do to see all others are lovable, especially those who I dislike, especially who have a different value?
Okay, so there are the two methods for doing it. The one in the 7-point cause and effect instruction, see sentient beings as your, that all sentient beings have been your mother. Reflect on their kindness when they've been your mother or your parent. And then let arise in you a wish to repay that kindness. So that's one way. And then the second way is to really sit down in your life and think that everything you have, everything you know, everything you do is dependent upon the labors of others. And that you don't even know who most of these people are, what they do that enables you to be, have, know, and do what you be, have, know, and do. Okay? And so to really feel that interrelatedness. And then if your mind thinks, but they've also harmed me, they haven't only benefited me, then think, oh, they may have harmed me, but compared to the number of times they've benefited me, the harm has been completely insignificant. Yeah? And so you have to really, again, repetition, contemplating this again and again.
I'm just wondering about the order of the meditation, that the 7-point, the disadvantages of self-centeredness comes after the 5 reasons. But I think it would also work having these come, do these before the 5 reasons.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I think the 5 reasons, that there you're just looking at it as a general way and making the determination that you want to cultivate those attitudes. And then having made that generation that those are things to cultivate and knowing that you can, then you start on the actual process of cultivating them. Yeah, I think that's why the 5 come before the actual meditations. Okay. Okay, is that it? Okay. We're going slowly, but this is quite fruitful, don't you think? Yeah? That's good.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lhasa's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the 3 worlds always increase.
Idam
Guru Mandala Kandiyatayami
Do. to this merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds of
explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially Ashravasti Abbey in the west,